Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the Master Manipulators podcast. My name is Grace Brown. I am the moderator this week, and I am joined by my classmates, and they are going to introduce themselves.
Hey, yo. Hello, hello, hello. My name is Emmanuel Anderson, but you can refer to me as Manny. I'm going to pass this phone over.
Hi, this is Lakaya Bullock, and... yep, that's that.
Unfortunately, I can't really compare to the energy Manny had, but hey, everyone. My name is Michael Clinton. It's good to have you all hear what I have to say today. And oh, God. I messed it up.
That's totally okay. We're going to keep rolling with it because, you know, mistakes happen. That's where we learn. All right, everybody. So today we are going to be having a conversation about the book by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Our main discussion today is going to be about systemic racism. And because of the topic this week, I'm having all of my co-hosts and I state our identities at the beginning of the conversation. That way y'all can see the lens we are coming from and how our experiences relate to this topic. So I, Grace Brown, am a white cis female living in the U.S. And I'm going to pass it off.
I, Lakaya Bullock, am a cisgendered black female living in the United States from a middle class socioeconomic status.
Awesome. Manny here. I am a cisgendered black man who lives in the United States of, I would say, middle class socioeconomic status. I'm going to pass it over.
Hey, so I'm also a cisgender and I'm a white male. While I do have some Native American heritage, I sadly do not have any contact with that side of my heritage.
Cool. So that's a little bit about your co-host this week. And I'm going to start us off in the conversation. So as I said, we are talking about systemic racism. We are talking about some pretty heavy stuff. This is important stuff. This is stuff that needs to be discussed in all classrooms, in all aspects of our life. And I'm going to start us off by stating a question that Dr. Tatum wrote in her book about a question a student asked her. The student asked, oh, is there still racism? And Dr. Tatum states, there's always someone who hasn't noticed the stereotypical images of people of color in the media, who haven't observed the housing discrimination in their community, who haven't read the newspaper articles about documented racial bias and lending practices among well-known banks, who isn't aware of the racial tracking pattern at the local school, who hasn't seen the reports of rising incidents of racially motivated hate crimes in America, someone who hasn't been paying attention to the issues of race, which a lot of this goes back to our discussion, which we'll be talking about later, on privilege and white privilege specifically. But I wanted to introduce our topic to this week with the recent current event in shooting in Buffalo, New York. This was a racially motivated shooting, and it killed 10 black individuals. And this is just going to start us off on our conversation of racism still exists. It's here and prevalent just as it was 50, 60, 100 years ago. So I'm going to open up this discussion with my classmates and my co-hosts, and we will be discussing this current event.
All right. This is Manny here again. So when I saw the incident that happened with the 18-year-old white man in Buffalo, New York, I was absolutely horrified. And it kind of reminded me of like how there's still work that has to be done as far as like dismantling racism as a structure that still affects us even today, contemporarily, and something that's been affecting us historically. One thing I never understood is that being a black person in America, I feel like everything has been maximized as far as like actions, as far as like thoughts. Oftentimes, I hear that, oh, if you do something bad, it's going to be a reflection of the entire Black community. However, when you have an individual such as this, a white person who conducted a whole mass shooting, it's treated as like an isolated incident. Nobody's ever saying that, oh, this is why white people as a whole are, you know, this way and everything like that. It's treated as, oh, as like some type of othering from that white person and saying, oh, well, white people like that are bad. We're not bad and everything. Whereas like being a Black person is just like, oh, you're all bad. Oh, if one of you does it, then all of you you're going to do it. So it kind of reminds me of how that one revolving topic that's like, it's not enough to be, what is it, non-racist? Mm-hmm. Like, you actually have to be anti-racist. Like, you have to be an ally when it comes to standing up against racism. You can't be idle. You can't be passive. You can't be quiet about it. You can't be complicit about it. You have to actually stand up for it and realize that it's wrong. And I know that that can be very hard to do, but it's necessary. So, again, with this incident, I thought it was disgusting. I think more people should be talking about it because this could happen anywhere in America at any time. We have so many mass shootings that happen annually. And honestly, it kind of made me look at my surroundings a little bit more. And it doesn't really help that it's so easy to access a gun in America. So yeah, it was horrifying. It kind of made me a little bit more aware of my surroundings. It kind of even made me want to like protect myself, in any way that I see fit. So that's kind of what I think about it. That's all I have to say right now. So.
Thank you, Manny. Lakaya is now going to take over.
I think my sentiments towards the situation were very similar to Manny's in that I just feel scared. It's a common occurrence to feel kind of afraid of being in America as it is now. As like Dr. Tatum said, we do live in a racist society. So just functioning every day, there's a lot of things that I have to be aware of that I feel like I shouldn't have to be. And so I feel like a lot of the rhetoric surrounding this situation is similar to what Dr. Tatum touched on with the myth of the colorblind millennial, similar to Dylann Roof's incident, I guess, in 2015, where he murdered 9 Black people in a church. The quote from the book says, he's 21, which means he's a millennial, which means he's not supposed to be racist. And the shooter in Buffalo was 18. And I feel like a lot of people are thinking that this is not something that is, I guess, racist because he's supposed to be so educated and informed and also, do better, you know? And I just find that hard to believe. I was reading up on it on an article and they talked about how this was like a premeditated incident. And like in December, he was writing on, different forums about how he called Black people the replacers and that he needed to like control, like, I guess, do population control in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that, that he sees it as an issue of people of color are taking over. And I think Dr. Tatum actually touched on this a little bit in the beginning, saying like the population, like the word minorities is very outdated because the majority is actually becoming people of color, yet they are still people who are being marginalized in this country. I think marginalized is the word I want to use. But yeah, I think the incident in Buffalo just kind of emphasizes how things that we feel like have moved past and we're growing into a better society for our children, while there are things that have changed, it's still generations perpetuating these continuous racist ideas, which is what causes us to live in a racist society. And like you said in the beginning, racism still exists. So, yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Lakaya, for your input. I just want to note after that, you know, the reason that we are having this conversation right now is because it is so imperative. And current events, such as the one that recently happened in Buffalo, as both Lakiya and Manny said, are not like individual incidents. They happen a lot. And it is not on the, it is not the responsibility of Black people or people of minorities to educate those with privilege, especially those with white privilege, on these sorts of topics and conversations. You know, systemic racism is really something that people need to be able to educate themselves on. And it's imperative that these conversations happen in classrooms and they happen with friends and family. And I think that was why we felt it was important that we bring in this current event so that we can show this stuff is still happening. This is why it's important these conversations happen. This is why it's important that people educate themselves so that people can look at that incident and say, oh, that's systemic racism. That is a product of systemic racism. How do we fix the system? And then I'm gonna hand this off to Michael and he might have some input as well.
So I actually wanted to go back a little bit about like what Manny was saying about how with white people in particular, they see these sorts of atrocities inflicted by another white person and they don't necessarily associate themselves with that person, which, so it's not necessarily that just because, you know, someone that shares the same skin color of you as you does something bad that you should immediately think that somehow you're also guilty. That's a little too far in the other direction. But the thing is, if white people stop when they see someone else that's white do something awful and racist or anything really that, you know, they shouldn't do, if I just stopped at saying, oh, well, that's not me, so I don't really care, that's not good enough, because also, of course, an aspect of racism can be not just that you yourself have done something to perpetuate the problem, but also your lack of action, the choosing or making the decision to not do something in order to attempt to fix the problem, or not doing anything to stop the people that are committing these acts. It's like the trolley problem. If you decide that you're going to do nothing, then you've decided to contribute to the worst outcome. Not deciding to do something, trying to remove yourself of responsibility, is in and of itself another decision. And it's the wrong one.
Yes. Thank you, Michael, for your input. So to segue into the next part of our discussion, I think from that incident and from what we just discussed, you know, we can say that racism is real and racism is prevalent. Systemic racism is prevalent in our society. Racism today can look like, and this is just to name a few, and I'm not saying these are more important than other forms of systemic racism, but just to touch on a few, mass incarceration. If you look at the Trump campaign and presidency, what he ran his campaign off of was racism, police brutality, redlining. And for the sake of this conversation, I did want to touch on mass incarceration, and I will hand this off to my co-hosts as well. But I wanted to first talk about what Dr. Tatum stated on page 14 in her book, and she says, more African-American adults are under correctional control today in prison or jail on probation or parole than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. More Black men are in prison today than at any other moment in our nation's history. And she states that a dramatic reason for this increase in incarceration is not due to a rising crime rate. Rather, it can be traced back directly to changes in drug sentencing laws, since the war on drugs during the Reagan administration, the number of Americans incarcerated for drug offenses has skyrocketed. So I'm going to pass it off to my co-host as we open discussion on mass incarceration and what racism looks like today in our society.
Hey, Manny here again. So with the topic of mass incarceration, it reminds me when I watched this documentary called 13th on Netflix, and it talked a lot about how Black as well as brown people are disproportionately represented in the prison industrial complex, despite having like really low populations in the United States. I believe that Black people make up like about 13% of the population, but they're more likely to be convicted and in prison for crimes more often than white people are. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you go back to how, I guess, jail or prisons were started, I think it was referred to like as slave patrol. There would be people in, you know, these law enforcement positions who would arrest Black people for the most menial crimes. Like, you could be arrested for loitering. You could be arrested for doing all these minor things. And I think that because of how society and the world has evolved, now you're still seeing Black people in jail, like probably even for things that they didn't even do. It also reminds me of that case where there's a lot of cases where a lot of white men have gotten off for doing like the most heinous things. Like there was this one, what was his name? Brock Turner, I think so. Yeah, Brock Turner, who was like a swimmer, and he got caught raping like a woman, and he got like a slap on the wrist. I think he got like a couple of months of like prison time, whereas like if the person was Black, they probably would have gotten a lot of time. A lot of time for that. Even with the main one, a really big topic, marijuana, you know, marijuana possession, marijuana like usage and everything like that. I don't know the statistics on the top of my head, but I do know that that's something that black men are more likely to be, again, convicted of and sent to prison, whereas like white people, they have not. Yeah, they get a slap on the wrist. Yeah, and you know, and then I think about the hardcore drugs, such as like, you know, heroin and meth and everything like that. And what do some white people get? Rehabilitation. Some type of rehabilitative services and everything. That's what I think when I think of mass incarceration. Like, it's so heavily ingrained with racism that it's so easy for law enforcement, which is mainly made up of white individuals, to over-police Black neighborhoods, to, you know, put Black people into the prison system. Another thing, what was it? It was on the top of my head.
While you're thinking, Manny, I just want to add to the topic on drugs and over-policing, especially over-sentencing of Black individuals, that white populations, and Dr. Tatum states this in her book, that white individuals and populations have a much higher use of drug use than Black populations and individuals. And that's just to point out that this doesn't have anything to do with who is using the drugs and who is not using the drugs. Everybody's using them, but they're higher in the white population. And then you look at how that correlates with who is getting incarcerated for these offenses, and it's mainly Black individuals and at a much higher rate. And then Michael, I think, has something to say.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I don't remember the exact statistics, but going into the word is leaving me, the disproportionate representation of minorities being convicted of crimes as compared to white people. So it's something like 9 out of 10 cars that are found with a firearm, like an unregistered firearm, are actually owned by white people. However, 6 out of 10 of the people arrested for having an unregistered firearm or a firearm in their vehicle and they like don't have a concealed carry license or anything like that, 6 out of 10 of those are Black. I don't feel like doing the math right now, but if you're willing to do the math, I think you'll be able to see just how problematic that is.
And for me, all of this talk about mass incarceration and then also our previous talk about the shooting in Buffalo, New York, just brings up all these incidences and just like how our main topic today, systemic, the racism is, and how in the public eye, how much white individuals who can commit crimes like get away with it in a sense or have lesser sentences. Like, I can't help but thinking of like the trial with George Floyd, Derek Chauvin, how much they had to fight for him to get some sort of sentence, or even Kyle Rittenhouse for murder. Yes. Kyle Rittenhouse, who shot and killed two black people, I believe. And I think he was acquitted. Even Trayvon Martin. The person who killed
George
Trayvon.
Zimmerman.
Yes, George Zimmerman. Thank you. He originally was okay until the Black Lives Matter movement started and everybody was like, this is not okay. He needs to be charged with murder. And just how, even like the insurrection on January 6th at the Capitol, just how public it is that white people have been able to
get away
with crimes that I, in my personal opinion, are far less severe than smoking weed by black people.
Far more severe. Far more severe.
Black people are sentenced to jail for far less severe crimes than what is publicly displayed as okay for white people, is what I was trying to say.
Yeah. And also, I just want something to add, you know, and honestly, to say that all of this that's happening is surprising, it's not. Because white people have been able to get away with so much historically that I think is just it's translating now into our system today. Like, white people were able to get away with lynchings. Like, at one point, that was actually legal. There were a lot of things that we would probably consider personally, like, immoral that white people were able to get away with. Like, having sundown towns, for example. They still exist.
People would say murder is immoral.
Yeah.
It's morally incorrect, but it's still happening.
Yeah, it's still happening. Like, and the fact that, you know, in the case with Dylann Roof and the kid, I'm not even gonna say a kid, that would be me infantilizing him, but the 18-year-old man, I forgot his name, but the care, like, that these individuals are getting after committing a mass shooting, they're not being pinned down to the ground, there's no knees on their necks, like, they're not being killed, they're not being shot down and everything like that, and it's taken so long for them to be, like, you know, convicted of, you know, what they did, like, murdered people. The fact that there's so many hoops and hurdles that law enforcement is jumping through to make sure that these individuals don't end up in the prison system as quick as they should be, that's a big problem to me, but it doesn't surprise me. Because, again, white people have been able to do whatever they want, no matter how wrong it is, for so long, and yeah, that's really all I have to say. That's what I was thinking of earlier, so, yeah.
Yeah, and so from there, I want to segue into, and, you know, I'm going to ask this question because I think it segues perfectly into kind of what we wanted to touch on next. So I can't remember the activist's name, but she states this question to a crowd, and she says, would white America like to be treated how black America is treated in the society? And the white people in the room, she's like, stand up if you would you like to be treated how black America is treated in the society? And nobody stood up. So I just think that goes to show that people, I mean, again, this is a crowd of people who are listening to an activist, but these people are aware. They are aware that, you know, the treatment of black Americans in our society is awful. Murder, small traumas, big traumas, but all of those lead to traumatic and intergenerational trauma for people. And I then want to segue into going off of that white privilege. And as someone, as I stated, I am white, cis woman. So in the book, Dr. Tatum states that she references Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack by Peggy McIntosh. So this is an advocate who, you know, she states, I was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems conferring dominance on my group. And so this, I just wanted to state a few of these so that y'all can see and really see how white privilege is active in our society today and what that looks like in forms of systems and systemic racism. So she says, and this is applying to me as well. So as I say I'm also applying these statements to myself. I am reading them off of Peggy McIntosh's article, but I'm applying them to myself as well. She says, I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. If I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing housing in an area which I can afford and in which I want to live. I can be pretty sure that my neighbors in such a location will be neutral or pleasant to me. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open to the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I'm told about our national heritage or about civilization, I'm shown that people of my color made it what it is. This is just to state a few. This is not all the ways in which my white privilege works within our society, but just to state a few. And then I want to open this conversation up then to lead to what passive racism looks like and what active racism looks like in our society. A lot of the statements that I just said are statements of how my white privilege works to interact in our system that play a role in passive racism. If I'm not aware of these things, I cannot do anything to change the systems in which my white privilege works to benefit me. And so just briefly, I'm going to define active racism and passive racism. So active racism is blatant, intentional acts of racial bigotry and discrimination. Passive racism is more subtle and can be seen in the collusion of laughing when a racist joke is told, letting exclusionary hiring practice go unchallenged, accepting as appropriate the omissions of people of color from the curriculum, and avoiding difficult race-related issues. Because racism is so ingrained in the fabric of American institutions, it is easily self-perpetuating. All that it is required to maintain is to go about business as usual. So, and saying that for someone with white privilege, all that is required to maintain this system is for me to go about business as usual, which is why it is important to be aware of your white privilege and how you can work to dismantle these systems at play. So I'm going to open up the conversation to my classmates, and I want to talk on passive racism because I think, you know, we often see examples of active racism, but passive racism is just as important to talk about, and it is more subtle, but it is equally as important. So I'm going to open it up to my co-host to talk about passive racism. Okay.
So I think from my perspective as a Black woman, I think in the way that Tatum described it, I cannot be racist, as the system is made to be against me and racially. But I do think that internalized oppression, like Dr. Tatum stated, definitely can contribute to me acting passively within a system that is racist. And because of the messages and everything that's perpetuated in society and that I received growing up, and especially being surrounded in a predominantly white area, I think I allow that internalized oppression to stop me from being vocal about, one, the oppression that I was experiencing, and two, like, I don't know, speaking out against what I was seeing. And so I just wanted to state that it extends upon further than just white individuals or the majority racial group. It's can be within all racial groups. And yeah, I think I have definitely, within the past few years, have tried to stop my, I guess, own form of passive racism and try to be more vocal, whether that be having conversations with people or doing things on social media. I still think that some ways that I can be more active, like going to protests and things like that, but there's still parts of me that are held back because of different things going on.
Systems of oppression.
Yeah, systems of oppression.
Just to note off of that, I think, Lakaya, that is a good point, but also to note in your, like, defense that the systems are at place are built to keep Black individuals from understanding this type of information, to keep this information out of schools. So to say that, yes, maybe you were not aware of those things, but that is how the system is built. And it was not like any wrongdoing of your sort that you were not made aware, because that is how the system is built. So I just wanted to note that, because Lakai is a very self-aware person, but she is not responsible for this type of stuff.
Okay. So as far as like what I think about, you know, the topics of like active, passive racism and like white privilege and everything. First of all, shout out to Robin DiAngelo. She wrote a book called White Fragility. Really like the book. And it touches a lot on white privilege and, like, of course, white fragility. So when I think of white privilege, oftentimes I think people equate it to, like, you know, oh, well, you know, white people struggle too. And I'm like, you know, but you're not struggling because you're white. You know, you may be struggling because of your class. You know, you may be struggling because you're poor. I don't mean to laugh, but you may be struggling because you're poor. You may be struggling because, you know, you're a part of like another marginalized community, but you're not struggling because you are white, because white is the dominant group in America and a lot of other places globally. So that's what I think about white privilege. It doesn't mean that you as a white person cannot struggle. As a person who's from Southwest Georgia, Albany, Georgia, it's like semi-rural, and who has seen white people from many walks of life, as far as like their class, there are white people that do struggle, but it's not because of their race. It's because of their positionality when it comes to like their class. Or again, like I said earlier, being a part of the LGBTQIA+ community, maybe even being of like a different religious background, like being Jewish or something like that. That's why you may be struggling, but it's not because you're white. Another thing, what I said earlier before, you know, got on this podcast, is that racism is definitely the overarching theme that is perpetuated by way of, like, you know, slavery, mass incarceration, like we talked about earlier, the Jim Crow laws that were put in place. That's the overarching thing that hasn't gone away. Now, I think, Lakai, you were touching on, like, racism and, like, the definition of it. Now, I've been asked the question, you know, can Black people be racist? You know, and my dad always told me that racism is prejudice plus power. And systemically, which is a component that many people don't like to acknowledge about racism, Black people cannot be racist. Now, if you're thinking about attitudes and behaviors, like, as far as, like, you know, like, that, maybe that's the prejudice. Yeah, it's like the prejudice aspect of it. But that systemic component, yeah, like that systemic component is so huge that we have not affected legislation to that degree where we're discriminating against white people or other non-Black people. We're not keeping white people let me just say non-Black. We're not keeping non-Black people out of neighborhoods. You know, we didn't create the separate but equal clause, which they found that wasn't really, you know, equal. We weren't the creators of that. And if anything, if there's any prejudice against white people by Black people, it's because of the racism that has been existing historically and currently. It's like a response to racism. Like there are some individuals in my family, like my aunt, like she has like a prejudice towards, you know, white people, but that's only because of like things that she's been through. That's only because of the oppression that she's felt by white people. It's not something that came out of thin air. It's not something that she just developed, you know. So, oftentimes people think that racism is just something that you call, like, oh, he called him the N-word. Like, oh, he pushed him because he was Black and everything. No, like, like microaggressions, and I'm pretty sure, like, Lakaya can, you can also attest to that, like being told that, oh, you're so well-spoken for like a Black person. Like, oh, where are you from? You don't sound like you're, I've been told, like, you don't sound like you're from Albany. I'm like, what am I supposed to sound like? You know? So, or like, you know, it's just, yeah, that it's just, there's so many, racism is systemic and it's multidimensional. People treat it as like this one-dimensional thing. That's just not it. So I'm going to, you know, pass it over.
I just want to note one thing after saying that, Manny, because I think it's really a good point to emphasize that, racism is a system involving, and this is what Dr. Tatum says, she says, racism is a system involving cultural messages and institutional policies and practices, as well as the beliefs and actions of individuals. So racism is not just a personal ideology, it is a system. And I think that's why it's really important to emphasize that, because when we're speaking of white privilege, and when people say, well, what is what? Well, the argument for white people is like, well, my life, as Manny said, my life's been hard, I've struggled, but your life has not been made harder because of your race. You can still struggle, you can still have really hard times in life, but those times are not due to the color of your skin. And that's a really big point that should be emphasized when having this discussion, because that's a big argument that white people will say when discussing white privilege and racism and what that looks like. I'm gonna pass this off to Michael.
I was gonna say, just talking about passive racism and things, I was gonna talk, well, as a white person, just a little bit about like my experiences with that, albeit seeing other people doing that sort of thing. And then also, unfortunately, times in my past where I was guilty of doing such things. But one thing I did want to touch on, because you, Manny, you were talking about how it's like, you know, white people can still struggle, but it's never because they're white. Like, I guess you could say, as a white person, can also concur that while there have definitely been times in my life where I've gone through some pretty bad stuff, I've had some pretty traumatic incidents occur to me, not a single one of them was because I was white. I can say that with absolute confidence, that they did not happen because I was white. but anyway, the really ironic thing is, though, kind of as a segue off of that, is that due to the things that happened to me in my past, I kind of ironically perpetuated the system of oppression through passive racism, because something that can happen with people, with like white people that have been, that have had something bad happen to them, is that it's like, oh, you know, I've also gone through some stuff and I was able to deal with it, I was able to come out of it, why can't, let's just say for the sake of brevity, why can't black people do the same? And I unfortunately have in the past thought things like that, partially because, you know, was raised in very rural Georgia, where I got taught that Columbus was a heroic explorer, and that, you know, racism ended with Martin Luther King. Very funny. And so with that kind of narrative, that ends up getting set up by society, a society ran by primarily rich white people, it becomes, they can even move the people that should be able to sympathize the most with the people that are oppressed and are somehow able to mobilize them against the people that they should be able to sympathize with, like not move against the oppressed people when they themselves are suffering as well, because they think that minorities are just being dramatic. Yeah. And it's horrible. Yeah. And that's not how it should be. It's logically, it's just so backwards, but that's how the system has been set up. Yeah. For people to think.
Yeah, and even poor white people treated black people like crap. I just want to say that.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to say that,
like, with everything that was going on, like, you know, we learned about Marxism, you know, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie and everything like that, people who were in the upper class. You know, of course, upper class treating the working class like crap, but even white people in the working class were treating black people like crap. So it was like that extension of oppression. And again, it wasn't because those white people were white. It was just because they were poor. And, you know, and those white poor people, like I said, were treating the black people who were seen as, like, you know, subservient, like people who were seen as less than, were still treated like crap. Yeah. So that's, I wanted to briefly mention that.
Yes. Okay. So we are wrapping up our podcast, but I want to finish what everyone has noted on this topic that, or this discussion that Dr. Tatum puts in her book. She says, I sometimes visualize the ongoing cycle of racism as a moving walkway at the airport. Active racist behavior is equivalent to walking fast on the conveyor belt. The person engaged in active racist behavior has identified with the white ideology of white supremacy and is moving with it. Passive racist behavior is equivalent to standing still on the walkway. No overt effort is being made, but the conveyor belt moves the bystanders along to the same destination as those who are actively walking. Some of the bystanders may feel the motion of the conveyor belt, see the active racists ahead of them, and choose to turn around, unwilling to go the same destination as the white supremacists. But unless they are walking actively in the opposite direction at a speed faster than the conveyor belt, unless they are actively anti-racist, they will find themselves carried along with the others. And so just to know, as a white person, I cannot be anti-racist unless I'm walking against the conveyor belt. And this goes in to show that, like, you have to do the work, you have to put in the work, otherwise you are just a passive person withholding up the systems that are in place. And I think that's why it's important that white people do the work and put in the work and do not put this responsibility on Black individuals or minorities to educate them on these topics, because you are a participator in the system. You are being passive or active. Whether you are being passive or actively contributing to the systems that are in place, you are upholding the system. So just ending it on that note. And so because we have discussed some heavy things today, I want to end on a more positive note. Dr. Tatum, in the book, you know, she discusses that systemic racism has its roots very deep within our society, but systemic change is possible. It is something that, you know, we can work to dismantle. Obviously, this change does not happen overnight. It is not an easy thing, but it is possible. And I just wanted to reference what she talks about at Mizzou, where the students came together and demanded that the president who did not acknowledge the hate crimes that had happened within Ferguson. He just did not touch on the topic. The students demanded that he be removed, and he did get removed. So it shows that change can happen. And when people put in the work and when people demand it, there are things that can change, and it's possible. But I just want to open this up also to my co-hosts on what they think are good ways to enact change in life, and also touch on the people who are leading these movements for the most part, who are leading the change in our society. So I'm gonna open it up to Lakaya.
So good change that is happening and can happen. One of the first things I thought of was, during this past presidential election, Georgia, for the first time in I don't know how long, turned blue and voted Democratic. And it just kind of goes into, like, I guess, unveiling that voter suppression and, like, people actively participating in the government and, like, caring and willing to voice their concerns and actually do something about it. Not saying that there are people that don't vote because they don't care, but there is also a bunch of people who couldn't vote because they were, I guess, held back by the systems that have been in place that have existed for a long time, like redlining, et cetera, like we've talked about earlier. And like the person that comes to mind for that was Stacey Abrams. She's doing great with helping end voter suppression, at least in Georgia. So yeah, that was one of the things that came to my mind.
Okay, so I guess what we're talking about now is, like, you know, of course, like, change is possible, you know, progression is possible as far as, like, you know, countering racism. And I think what it really takes is, it sounds kind of funny, but you have to be willing to make enemies. You have to be willing to fight back against people in dominant groups. And that's, I know we're specifically talking about race, but that applies to, or that generalizes to every other dominant group, whether, you know, you're white, whether you're straight, whether you're any other, whether you're subscribed to any group, you really have to have that willingness. You really have to care enough, because living in a bubble, in a, you know, similar, like, I'm a man, you know, there's a lot of privilege in being a man. Living in the bubble is very easy. It's very easy to be a bystander. It's very easy to not, like, engage when things are going wrong. But it takes a lot of courage to actually step up and say something. And I'm often inspired by, you know, my ancestors, who were probably in the civil rights movement, who were willing to die for that. Like, there was a lot of people who were willing to die just for us to get some type of change. And that's, like, a really huge pill to swallow. So when I think about change, it's, I think about how dominant groups have to work with marginalized groups in order to facilitate change. I think about how the civil rights movement, a question that comes in my head is, like, would the civil rights movement have worked if white people weren't involved? And, again, like I said, that's what it takes. It takes people of dominant groups to dismantle those oppressive systems that they created. It's going to take a lot more people to care. Now, do I think it's going to happen in this lifetime? I don't know. But, you know, we can hope. We can dream and everything like that. But right now, I think the best thing to do is, like just, you know, put a post up. If you feel comfortable enough to go to a protest, I know that there are, like, a lot of safety concerns when it comes to that. Just do your part. Even as something as simple as speaking out against a family member that says if they say something that's really disrespectful or really oppressive or something like that, you can always do your part. You can donate to organizations. You can go to town hall meetings. Voting, that's also a really good thing. There's always something that you can do, no matter how big or how small. So that's what I think about that.
Absolutely. I kind of want to go a little bit off of what Manny said towards the end, and it's just, no matter what you do, even if you have your suspicions and your doubts that what you're doing is not enough, at the very least, you can try to do something, no matter how small. Obviously, everyone has their own life to live. Everyone has their own problems that they need to deal with. But, you know, don't use that as an excuse to just resign yourself to live in a world that you feel like is wrong. Even if it's just as much as, you know, yeah, like calling someone out when they say something that's not okay. I mean, hell, my parents, just me, like, letting them know that some of the things that they have said and things that they have done in the past that they didn't think there was any problem with, making them realize that those things that they have said and done are bad and that they may have been racist or some type of oppression without them knowing has really opened their eyes. And I feel like that's one of the big keys is, like, we need to open as many people's eyes as possible. Yeah. And if that's all you can do, that's still great.
Yes. My co-host Manny wants to add.
Yes. So, and I agree with what everybody said. I think everybody had terrific takes and everything. Another thing I also think of is, and it's going to sound really simple, but listening. You know what I mean? Just listening to understand and also listening to comprehend where people are coming from as far as, like, their experiences and everything. Like, you don't have to say anything at all. I know that when, for example, if we talk about women, that's going to be dedicated to creating space for women to, you know, talk about things. And I think the same thing should be extended to race. When it comes to something that negatively impacts Black people or non-Black people and everything like that, I think white people, or if we're specifically talking about Black people, non-Black people should create space for Black people to air out, you know, things that they go through. It's all about creating space and letting people know that you're not going to be a safe space for oppression.
Absolutely. And as a white person, I think the listening piece is huge because as a white person, you know, when you're thinking about enacting change, you should not just assume what minorities or people of color want that change to look like. You should listen to their stories, listen to their experiences, and hear them, and work with them to enact the change that they want to take place. Obviously, I think the big change, dismantling racism, I hope that when you're working against that, everybody wants that. But listening to those stories, listening to what they want to happen instead of assuming that you know, is huge. But I just want to wrap it up, and I want to thank my co-hosts for being here this evening. I want to thank everybody for sharing their experiences and their take on these sorts of topics. I know it can be very heavy. And then I also just wanted to say shout out to our number one fan, Dr. Binish. Our inspiration for the podcast name came from him, so just had to give him a big shout out. And then I just want to end it on saying that we white people, me, Grace, me, Michael, that was not said correctly. We need to do the work. We need to put it in the work. And I think this book really touches on how and why we can do those things. And I think these conversations need to be had, and they need to continue happening. Like I said, I just want to thank my co-hosts for participating and sharing their experience. And yeah, hopefully we'll continue to have more conversations like this, and we will continue putting in the work. Good night, y'all.